Welcome to another edition of El Paso Primetime. And in the house, our one and only tummy doc, Dr. Richard McCallum, professor of medicine and founding chair of the Department of Internal Medicine and the director of the Center for Neurogastroenterology and GI Motility over at the Texas Tech Paul L. Foster School of Medicine and all that goes great with the city. Welcome back to El Paso Primetime, Doc.
Dennis, thank you very much. Good afternoon, audience. Looking forward to the new studio that's been incubating and in gestation for some months, but we're going to be viewing it in a few weeks. So we certainly thank Dennis for his patience and waiting for the new building, so to speak, to open, but I know he's excited as well.
Absolutely. We've been watching it go down piece by piece by piece as they've continually worked on the facility to make it the way we had always envisioned the room to be. So next month we will be live, but this time around there's so much to talk about. So let me go ahead and give you the stage, and then let's see where we go from here. We were talking just before we opened up the microphones, and we were talking a little bit about an experience you had with a student of yours.
Yes, Dennis, I had an interesting experience. I'm sure many of my colleagues in academic medicine and in practice, too, have this opportunity. The American College of Physicians opens up the door for you to be a preceptor or a mentor of a first or second year student, usually a first year student, medical student, to come and sort of be with you for a month and join you every day on your clinical and other activities to learn to know what you do, think about their medicine as a career for them, what they would like to go as far as their direction. And I had a very refreshing experience. It shouldn't have been surprising because I know there's wonderful young men and women out there preparing to be the next generation of doctors. But I had a young man called Jake Wilson from a small town in Texas who was here at Texas Tech, Paul L. Foster School of Medicine, who wanted to join me. It was a very pleasure for me and a privilege to be able to have his trust for the month. And we did a lot of good things together. He saw a lot of patients with me. We talked about like philosophy, saw some research, and I just want to say to the audience that you can rest assured the future of medicine is in great hands if we have the high caliber of individual that the young Jake Wilson is. So that was a refreshing month for me. One of the great benefits of academics, really, Dennis, is you recharge every year. You heard the tank is down. You wonder whether you've got any gas left, and new students come in, new residents come in as a sort of a new birth, and all of a sudden you crank up the tank and the energy goes up and you're excited again. So it was a nice little way to sort of begin the year.
From my catbird's perspective, yeah, your energy has never waned. Every time we talk, you're excited about anything and everything that comes your way when it comes to medicine and life in general. Let's talk about the free clinic. Yep. That's one of your pet projects.
It is. And again, I was down there this morning with Dr. Lynn Mansfield, one of our other colleagues that's in the Rotary world as well, an allergist in town. And we were the two doctors today with our students and some of the UTEP pre-med students who help us with registration, interpreting other things, labs. And we saw, 25 or 26 patients this morning. And again, that's very refreshing to see our students reaching out to the underserved, to be part of the community. What we encourage our students to do, Dennis, is not to be a bit like me when I was probably growing up in medicine, sort of in the ivory tower dispensing health and well-being in the ivory tower, a bit of a cocoon sort of secluded away at the university. We're encouraging people now to get down into the trenches, go downtown, go in the community, understand what your patients are living, understand the limitations, their social issues, their financial issues, how political changes may influence them. Be involved in the community you live in. You're part of it. And I think the students have embraced that. And this kind of free clinic is a clear sign that, we're out there perhaps not feeling all your pain, but sensing it and being involved.
Do you envision another free clinic possibly in Anthony, New Mexico, Anthony, Texas, out in the rural area to serve Vado, Chamberino, that kind of a thing?
Mm-hmm. There's one at Sparks, as you know, from our school. But, you know, I just got an invitation September the 9th, I believe it is, that they're opening the new DO school, Doctor of Osteopathic Medicine, in Las Cruces. This is going to be a joint venture between Las Cruces and, in some degree, Mexico. Students will have exposure to both states or countries. And so I suspect those students will be very motivated to reach out to the smaller counties and cities in around Las Cruces. So that may happen there. I don't know whether our students are ready to go to a sort of a third clinic, but we've got 100 a year now, so 400 students. I suspect we will be reaching out, Dennis. Yeah, I suspect we will.
You know, we're in the midst of the monsoon season here. It's been a very dry monsoon season, to be quite honest. I've been here long enough to know that monsoons can last as long as a month and a half. We'll have dropped a grand total of maybe about 3.5 to 4 inches of rain, standing water.
Yep.
But regardless of how much rain we get, you still have the mosquito thing.
Yep.
And everybody's worried about the Zika virus, but no one's really focusing again on West Nile or the other viruses that these little critters called mosquitoes can pass along.
Yeah, this has been, I think, a sudden change. I guess, you know, we've got people not going to the Olympics. We've got all sorts of things happening now in the name of the Zika virus. It's around, and most people are asymptomatically bitten and never know it, and will never know it. But there's that small subset, maybe it's 5 or 10%, who develop some of the sequelae, including more Guillain-Barré syndrome, which is more fearful. This is an ascending paralysis that could start in your legs and go up further up into your body, which minimizes movement for a while and can even affect the brain, a so-called encephalopathy. That definitely happens. Then, you've got in the female situation. You know, microencephaly has been going on. It's not unique to this particular virus. Probably other infections during pregnancy can interfere with the fetus. But it's certainly sort of on the rise as far as the publicity situation. But, yeah, you're right. West Nile virus. We've had one case, I think, that my public health people told me recently at our monthly El Paso Society meeting. Similar concerns from encephalopathy to respiratory problems. But, you know, given all the standing water around and people, you know, out and about in the summer, your number can come up. But you've got to look upon this as being rare, really, in the big picture of life, as far as being the one getting struck by lightning. But still, usual precautions are talked about, wearing more sleeved shirts. It's easy to say that here in this studio, Dennis, but not easy to do it out there in the hot summer.
Sure.
Getting rid of standing water, being careful about children, etc. Still rare, but we want to make sure the public realizes we take it very seriously.
Let's go back to the free clinic for just a little bit, because you're talking about a certain part of El Paso County that's always seemingly they become the victims of things like that and other other maladies that just crop up that you don't find in other suburban areas until you get way out into the rural parts. So what do you see most at that, other than like obesity and diabetes and all that?
Yeah.
Do you see anything else that's a little bit on the anomaly side?
Well, what we're seeing lately, Dennis, is a lot of clients or a lot of occupants of the halfway house. And these are folks who've been actually in prison and incarcerated or in some way, and have come out and are spending time. I didn't know actually the halfway house was so big. They just told us, talked to a patient this morning in some depth, and there's two sort of buildings, but there's over 500 occupants in these buildings trying to rehabilitate, get back into life. We see a lot of previous drug use, hepatitis C. From prison encounters and maybe previous life before prison, drug encounters. A lot of arthritis and traumatic offense affecting bones and spines and being in pain. So we're seeing a lot of that is not necessarily unique to perhaps the border region of El Paso. As far as the border region of El Paso, what would we think about more there? I don't think there's any one entity that jumps up that I'm going to see, you know, when I walk in the door, I'm thinking, gee, I'm going to see this today. I'm going to see more patients who have been neglected, particularly rampant blood pressure control issues that are not well controlled, diabetes that are not well controlled, things that have been let go, no preventive health care, hoping that things work out. More ABCs. I know we don't see tuberculosis rampantly. It's probably somewhere out there, perhaps. We see neglect. I saw a patient this morning who had a nail removed from his leg 5 years ago. The wound never healed. There's a gaping wound in his shin that we wonder, is that going through to his bone? Could this be osteomyelitis? Not in much pain, but every day his wife has to bathe it and dress it. And he comes in and sort of says, what's going on? Is there anything else I can do? So I think that's we often are catching up, Dennis, mm-hmm. in many ways down there.
There seems to be a new influx of illegal diet pills that the FDA mm-hmm. had banned back in 1986 that are starting to rear its head again here in the desert Southwest. The two diet pills that I'm thinking about, I can't remember the name anymore. I saw it earlier today. Mm-hmm. And I'm just wondering, you know, with so many different ways to lose weight, yeah. you know, in a healthy way, how is it that people will start resurrecting these illegal yeah. pills?
It's a good question, actually. We had Dr. Hale. Ann Hale was our gynecologist, obstetrician, guest today at the free clinic doing pap smears and female exams. Does it very well, so we designate that day for her. And I was talking to her actually about part of her other life is holistic medicine, weight control in that picture. And she's using a drug that combines Wellbutrin, which is an antidepressant, with naltrexone, which affects the narcotic receptors in the gut. And she gets good results with this drug. But we didn't bring up the amphetamines and some of these other agents that have been linked to heart disease and complications. It may be that, again, black market access seems easy. Let's start with these. I'll give you some samples now. You could buy them later from a doctor. Let's get started. You jump into it. You feel somewhat depressed. You're overweight. You're shopping at night on your own at 2 o'clock in the morning so people won't see you. You're somewhat of a hermit. You know, Dennis, this is a... It's a terrible psychological issue to feel the sort of lack of social acceptance because of your weight. You may have say that you had many chances to address it, but it's still there. Exercise is difficult. It's slow. It's that quick fix. Maybe I can get a jump start, lose 20 pounds in a month. You know, I could really make a difference here. You get sucked into it. And we'd have to warn our audience that there's no quick fixes out there, or we'd all be doing it. They know that. It's dangerous, and we can lose weight, but be willing to be thoughtful and careful. You do have to lose it slowly, but you can do it.
One of the things why I brought that yeah. up is because I was on Facebook earlier today, and yeah. I saw this one woman in town who wrote in Spanish that she had these two diet pills for sale. And it rang up a couple of red flags in my head because I remember covering this back in the 80s in Tucson, where there were four deaths attributed to this one drug in particular. It was a diuretic. There yeah. was okay, so
I was going to say that. You know, what people think, I mean, lay-wise, is let's have many bowel movements a day. You know, I must be having a lot of stool in my GI tract. If I could just stool all day, I could, you know, definitely start the ball rolling, or I could pass a lot of urine every day. So diuretics and laxatives, mm-hmm. yeah, these would be the easy, low-hanging fruit that could be happening out there. Diuretics, dangerous. Your potassium is peed out in the urine mm-hmm. along with water, and your potassium drops, so your heart becomes very susceptible to what's called arrhythmias or irregular rhythms, which can lead to fatal cardiac events. And the same with stool. If you pass enough stool in a diarrhea fashion every day, as in enemas and clean outs and these things that people do, high colonic enemas, you can lose potassium that way. So you're probably tapping into a potassium heart effect where you could suddenly have an acute event and not make it to the hospital. And so I think you probably hit on a nice note there that for the average person, passing a lot of urine and stool must be a quick way. I can lose a lot of weight quickly here. And that obviously carries all those risks I just mentioned.
Oh, absolutely. So,
yeah.
You know, just be wise about what you're looking for, pretty much.
Yeah, be curious and realize that, unfortunately, there are some fixes, but if it was great and legal and safe, you know, we'd all be probably a little more prominently displaying those opportunities. But don't give up. There are drugs safely being given by good physicians with some knowledge of the area where you are losing weight. Maybe it's 2 pounds a week, but you are losing weight, and it's not a hopeless cause.
Which brings me to another topic. There are people who are considering bariatric surgery. That's a rather extreme way to lose weight. Even though it is medically approved, it's not for everybody.
Right. So where it's gotten a lot of press recently, Dennis, is particularly in diabetes. So if you're a 400-pound diabetic who's sort of going nowhere in every sense of the word, diabetes is harder to control. My blood pressure's an issue now. I can't exercise much, and I've got back pain. You can get kind of a dual benefit. A bariatric surgeon could present to you the case, that is, if you could lose 100 pounds or more with my surgery, you could possibly lose your diabetes. There are many cases now where dropping 100 pounds can change you from a type 2 diabetic into a person with probably normal blood glucose levels. So in that subset, we're being, I wouldn't say more aggressive, but I'm certainly being more open to my patients saying, look, I'm treating you for your diabetes, your GI problems that are due to your diabetes. But look, you're a young man or woman. Why don't we do something that could be a life changer here? If you could lose 100 pounds and lose your diabetes, you know, we could restart the clock and begin again. So I think in that subset of patients, Dennis, there's some new excitement. Overall, there are exit wounds. As I tell my patients, you know, no one's going to get out of this life without some suffering. There's no easy roads. Something will eventually, you'll encounter something. If you take on the surgery, I'm going to lose weight, I'm going to look good, but I'm going to have small meals to eat. I may intermittently vomit. I'm going to have variable amount of diarrhea. I have a lot of bloating and gas. There are changes in the anatomy and in the way that we divert your GI tract, which open up doors that can cause issues. But you've got to take the big picture. This was almost a life-saving event to me mentally and physically. I've got to expect a few exit wounds. Just like chemotherapy and surgery for cancer. Yeah, you're suffering during some of that time, and maybe after it, but I'm alive. You know, I beat cancer. There are some prices to pay, but these are the balancing acts of medicine. This is why we have informed consent, and we discuss the pros and the cons. There's many pros to obesity surgery. It's transformed many people that were really going nowhere, if you like, mentally and physically.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit about a little bit of discomfort in order to save a life.
Yes.
And that's called the colonoscopy.
All right. Well, the colonoscopy, Dennis, the most discomfort is the preparation. And I'm finding male Hispanics are the most refractory. Women, you know, are very either trusting or they want to live longer to see more grandchildren or something. Men seem to be very skeptical and worry about, why are you having me do this? Even though my father may have had colon cancer even, I've had trouble talking people into it. But the worst is the prep. So you start drinking a laxative liquid drink on the day before, in the afternoon or the morning, and goes into the early evening and night, and then next day you have it. So that day of diarrhea kind of makes people nervous. It shouldn't. It's more gentle if you start early in the day and drink liquids along with it and not big meals. But then during the procedure, you're knocked out. We either give a powerful drug called fentanyl, or in some surgeries in the city, we give the Michael Jackson drug, propofol, and you're totally out. So what we've got to try to remember to tell people is that one day of your life at the most, every 10 years, gives you a chance to see your family grow, your grandchildren grow, and your own life continue. That's a small sacrifice compared to what all the other things we do in life to get by. One day every 10 years, and you're asleep for the tough part of it, and the diarrhea part is really minimal. Everyone gets diarrhea from gastroenteritis anyway. So, but we don't vomit. We just have diarrhea in this case. So we try to – there is a blood test that's getting a bit of press where you can – it's evolving. The future is DNA markers, cancer markers in the blood. That could maybe alter the game in that we don't start to age 50. Some people say, gee, I'm in my 40s, doctor. Should I get a blood test just to be sure? Or if your father or mother died of cancer, you should have it – colon cancer, you should have your first colonoscopy 15 years before the index case. So maybe your mid-30s or 40. But this blood test may be a procrastination approach as well, but if you get it and it's negative, you may feel better. But right now you shouldn't, because it's not enough. This is not the world's most accurate test. We still need a colonoscopy. Over the next 5 years, probably blood testing for cancer markers will become very good, maybe at selecting even further who should be screened, but probably earlier. Yeah, we got the game covered from 50 on, but even though we told patients and preach the gospel of a prophylactic colonoscopy at 50 and there every 5 to 10 years, a third of the country who is eligible to have this over the age of 50 have not done it. A third of the country, but we've had a major impact by taking out small polyps and not getting cancer of the colon. We've made a major impact, Dennis. But it's amazing that a third of the country have not yet jumped on that opportunity to get a colonoscopy beginning at age 50, a free colonoscopy mandated by the country. And yet we've got reluctance.
I don't understand how, yeah. You know, I'm scheduled for next year.
Okay.
Mine was 9 years ago, 8 and a half. So next year is my turn to have the... Have me checked.
Yeah.
You know, it's not a big deal. I mean, yeah, you're right.
And the reassurance after, Dennis, is amazing. You can come back to work and say, gee, you know, I've got other problems to work on in my life, but I've got a 5 or 10 year pass here. I'm not going to go out that way.
Right.
I may have other issues to work with, but to get a reprieve like that with a 1 hour investment that day of the colonoscopy being in your colon and you're asleep. It's very hard not to get to sort of be annoyed at patients in a way for not being very happy that you're bringing it up. Has your father had one yet? Yeah, they should be glad with thinking of it. Women love pap smears and breast exams. Don't love it, but they embrace it. Maybe
okay.
We're not getting that feedback yet, so we got to work harder, Dennis.
Yeah, I would venture to say they don't like the mammogram, but.
Yeah.
They certainly do appreciate the end results for what they're testing for. So with about 5 minutes left to go in the show, what are you working on personally in terms of research and whatnot?
We're doing a couple of interesting things, Dennis. It's interesting you'd ask. We just met with one of my co-investigators this week. We started to ask the question is when you have a lot of nausea and or vomiting from conditions we call gastroparesis, the stomach won't empty, or a condition called cyclic vomiting, dramatic attacks of vomiting every couple of weeks or months. In these days, often marijuana-driven, what's called cannabis hyperemesis. But anyway, nausea and vomiting of whatever etiology or cause, what are the centers in the brain that are affected or start to become activated that lead to the cycle, the cascade of vomiting? So we've been subjecting some of our patients with nausea and vomiting and gastroparesis to come in and get an MRI study. This is called functional magnetic resonance. And we provoke nausea by having them watch a computer screen of a circle of black and white circles going around and round and round. It's like sort of the astronauts training in a chair that rotates around and around and around till they're nauseated to train them for space. We're giving a modest form of that where we do this black and white squares and circles going around and around on a computer very close to them, and they get nauseated. And when they get to a certain point, 5 to 6 out of a 10 score, we don't want them to vomit, they go back under the MRI machine, the magnetic resonance imaging machine. And we're starting to learn about some very important centers in the brain One's called the insula, one's called the cingulate lobe, areas of the brain that may in turn lead us to more specific treatments, looking at certain receptors and chemicals that might be in those regions. So that's getting an older researcher like me excited, Dennis. That's new work, brain imaging. And I think the rest of our work is really an excitement. And in the next 5 years, if I can last that long, we may have a cure for gastroparesis, the reason the stomach stops working in diabetics particularly. We're getting down to the molecular level now. We may be able to give some pre-treatment from stem cells to other things that may actually prevent the muscles and nerves of the stomach from being attacked by diabetes. We can't predict about the heart and the kidneys yet and the eyes, but we think we may be able to get to the root cause of why the stomach stops working, an actual cure for that entity called diabetic gastroparesis. So those are things that still get me up in the morning, Dennis, and excited about research.
Absolutely. Yeah. One of the things, and we've only got a couple of minutes, but I know sometimes mentioning stem cells sends up a red flag in people, and I don't understand why, because there are so many different types of stem cells. Yeah.
Exactly. So, and they're very easy to culture. It's not as if we bring up images of fetuses and stealing tissue, though. Those days have gone. You can get stem cells from even skin and other places in the body that are multipotential. They're waiting to find a focus. If you put them in the environment, the brain, the stomach, a certain milieu or environment, they are coached or sort of stimulated or coaxed into becoming part of that system. So we use multipotential undifferentiated cells that in the right environment mature and grow and replace ones that have unfortunately faded or been damaged. So yeah, that image will hopefully go, that stem cells are some sort of, you know, mysterious backdoor research that shouldn't be funded. It's not everything, but it's certainly in the brain. It could be a new part of recovering from strokes. Work to be done. That's going to be an exciting area, Dennis. If I was a young physician now, I would probably think about the neurosciences. It's, I think, trying to resurrect the brain, prevent degenerative Alzheimer's type diseases, sustain neurons and memory and life, work out all those pathways. That's going to be a very exciting time.
I'm excited that we get to do this again on a live basis next month, August 13th, 1 o'clock, El Paso Primetime. Dr. Richard McCallum, thank you so much for joining us.
Dennis, I can't resist just saying, audience, that I had the pleasure of being with Dennis to see James Taylor a couple of weeks ago, and I think we're still recovering. We had a great time.
Absolutely.
Thanks again, Dennis, for the show. Looking forward to being with you in the new studio. And audience, look forward to your calls live next time. Good afternoon.